The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are lazy, but because they are hard.
Start by a list of 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning West Coast time space show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in this morning. And we're going to be talking about additive printing, 3D printing, space, the space economy, all sorts of related topics from a little bit of a different perspective this morning. Before I introduce our guest, a couple of very quick announcements. We're on the 60-minute format today. Please watch your clock, and if you do want to call our guest or send us an email, make sure you do it during the 60-minute window. Our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And as always, email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. The other little tidbit is that daylight savings time changes on Sunday. Everybody pay attention to that. And we have an open lines discussion on Sunday. And we welcome all of your callers, your calls. We, you know, if you can keep it on space and science and tech, that's fine. But we want to hear from you. And that'll be Sunday at noon. And now the time will be Pacific Daylight Time. So I know not all of you change to daylight savings time, so do pay attention to the time change so you don't miss our Sunday program. The Space Show does have a newsletter, and it goes out every Monday morning around 6 a.m. West Coast time. If you want to get it, make sure I have your email address. Remember, we archive everything. We have a store or logo where you get to that store clicking on Pepper listening to the Space Show. Pepper is my Siberian Husky, and she actually doesn't listen to the Space Show, but she does come up and sit with me while I do the show most of the time. Probably the most important part of all of this is that we're listener-supported, nonprofit, 501c3 radio, meaning you, the listener, you keep us going. We could not do this program without your contributions and financial support. If you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if that's important to you, please do know that. We are now a Nevada corporation. All of that is unfolding for us right now. But we also offer sponsorships and what we call billboard advertisements. So the sponsors get those banner ads that you see rotating across our homepage. They can change that banner whenever they want. And they also, on the longer format shows, get a PR message that they write and I read. But on the shorter format shows, like today, I shout out to our great sponsor because we would not be doing this show without them. So I certainly want to thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and as an advertiser, Dr. Ben Arroyo, with his great books on lunar habs, lunar development. Remember, if you buy his books through his banner ad, Amazon will donate a portion of the sales price back to the Space Show. And we really appreciate that. If you have any questions about our nonprofit listener-supported radio, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our guest today is Fabian Alfeld, hopefully I got that right. He is the senior North American manager for Additive Minds Consulting Services, which is part of the larger business EOS, which we will talk about in just a minute. And they do a lot of work in consulting with different space companies, including NASA. He also runs a podcast, and he's been talking on that podcast of late, and he did four of them, he said, that were all with space companies. So he really does know and understand the space economy, the commercial space side of it, and what it means to have cheap and easy access and transportation. And the tagline is that the innovations that don't exist today will dominate tomorrow. And Fabian will be able to address that. Welcome to our program today. How are you? And it's very nice to meet you here on the Space Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I'm super excited to be here. And yeah, also thank you for the introduction.
Why don't we start with you supplementing my introduction with your interest in space. How did you get your interest in space? Was it before you started working with the consulting in EOS, or have you been a long-time space fan?
No, I mean, I would say growing up in Germany, Germans certainly have less exposure to organizations such as NASA or now SpaceX than you do have in North America. But I've always had an interest in space, always also dabbled as a kid in certain tools and engineering in my father's garage. But yeah, ultimately the bigger fascination truly came up when I joined EOS and joined the consulting side of the business, where we do, of course, get exposure to a lot of interesting and innovative applications in the space industry, but also in others, of course, such as automotive and medical, where we do see how new technologies such as additive manufacturing can drive the innovation of industries such as the space industry.
There has been 3D printing in space for a while, starting, I guess, with Made in Space many years ago, which we've covered. And I know it's continuing, and I guess it's sort of still experimental, and we have a rocket trying to get launched that's all been made by 3D printing. I'm curious, is additive manufacturing or 3D printing, is it like the key, the main innovative technology, or because it's getting more well-known and getting used more, there are more advanced technologies coming in for space manufacturing and space services than 3D printing?
I would say that additive manufacturing is certainly one of the key enablers of the current space race that we're seeing. And there's various reasons for it. First of all, most people don't even realize that additive manufacturing today is a core piece and technology of most rockets that we see launching in space today. A large majority of combustion chambers and combustion chamber assemblies are additively manufactured today from all major space organizations, but we're also now seeing different applications such as turbopumps, even fuel tanks now going into space that have been 3D printed. And There's a few reasons for it. One reason that is actually quite obvious is additive manufacturing allows for rapid R&D, right? Additive manufacturing was really born as a prototyping technology back in the late 80s and has matured throughout the 90s and early 2000s. And I think the first true exposure that additive manufacturing had in the space industry, there's a post from Elon Musk, even I think from 2011 on an EOS machine, where they're starting to experiment with additive manufacturing and nozzles. And yeah, really back then it allowed for, you know, designing a part, printing it overnight over a few days, assessing it the next day, compared to some, you know, other technologies that in the conventional space take way longer to bring a a digital file to a physical product. I think that was the first impact that Adolf von Fleischer had, was to accelerate the innovation pipeline.
Is the same thing true in Russian space hardware and Chinese space hardware and Indian space hardware and Israel's making space hardware? Are they all using additive manufacturing, or some of them are not there yet?
Not all of them are there yet. I cannot speak too much about the Russian space programs or the Chinese space programs. There's not much information that that swaps over, and they're not using our technology. But we do know that, for example, the Japanese space program that recently actually failed is using additive manufacturing for certain components in their rockets.
What is this doing? You said it was the key enabler. What is it enabling? I can understand it's shortening the R&D time and the development mm-hmm. time. How does this impact economic markets demand, more or less common components of an economic equation? Because you want to be
sure.
profitable, right? So how does this make you more profitable? How does it we even have companies wanting to manufacture in-space hotels and things like that. How is this showing up in helping them do something that nobody really knows how to do today?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, we're certainly beyond the R&D times as the key benefit of additive manufacturing. The true benefit, and maybe I even take a few steps back and explain the technology of additive manufacturing. Ultimately, what we do is we build an end product in a layer-by-layer process. In our case, we use a thin layer of metal material in that case, let it be a copper alloy such as GR-COP42, which was developed by NASA. And with a very small increment from 30 micrometers to up to 80 micrometers, we're melting the material around solid structures later on. So with 30 to 80 micron layer thicknesses, we're building a part from the ground up, which allows us to create structures that are not possible to create with conventional manufacturing technologies or very difficult to create with conventional manufacturing technologies. And I think a prime example are combustion chamber assemblies, right? Conventionally, these combustion chamber assemblies, which consist of a nozzle, the actual combustion chamber, and a injector, those are assembled out of multiple different applications. They're welded together. And therefore, we have a very long lead time for these combustion chamber assemblies. But also B, we have a lot of weak points, especially in the welding points of these assemblies. And with the additive manufacturing process, what we can now do is we can build this whole assembly in one piece from the ground up, which is benefit number one. And benefit number two, due to the fact that we can create very complex geometries with additive manufacturing, we can now create regeneratively cooled cooling channels throughout the wall of this combustion chamber, which allows for higher performance of this combustion chamber assembly. And therefore, we have two additional benefits, which is A, weight reduction of the whole assembly, typically 40%. That makes sending things into space cheaper because I can now increase my payload. And on top of that, we can also optimize the performance of these combustion chambers, which means by reducing the weight, we can also increase the performance and additionally increase the payload of my final rocket.
Do you help or instruct companies and individuals within companies on how to do additive manufacturing or how to bring it to their company? What if they're a space hardware company and they don't have this capability? Is what you do help them develop this capability in-house, or do you do it for them on a contract basis?
So we mainly focus on enablement, so the first point that you mentioned. And on a daily basis, we engage with companies in the space industry, but also outside of the space industry, to enable engineers to truly leverage the technology to its full potential, right? Luckily, within space, I have to say, we have a lot of bright minds, and we have a lot of talent in the space industry that truly understands how to design for additive manufacturing and how to push the limits. Nevertheless, there are still, of course, developments happening on a daily basis where we can continuously work with space companies out there to advance existing designs and adopt different applications for the technology.
You have an initial email message from our listener in San Diego, California, Todd, and he says, how do you adopt the manufacturing to work in a zero-gravity or microgravity high-radiation environment?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There is a lot of research going on in that space, literally. Paul Gradle, who works at NASA, for example, is also part of some research that is trying to understand how can we adopt additive manufacturing in zero gravity. It can be a bit more difficult for powder-based technologies because, as you can imagine, powder and zero gravity don't go well together. But there's other technologies such as direct energy deposition, for example, which uses a wire and a different energy source, for example, a laser, to then basically arc weld a product in layers that could be adopted. And then there's other companies more in the building space. One of them is actually here based in Austin, Texas, who are trying to understand, can we use moon dust as a base material to then build habitats on the moon and beyond compared to bringing construction material up into space?
How do you experiment with that? Because you don't have the moon dust to work with, so I know you have simulated regolith. Is that good enough? Or when you don't have the real product, how do you simulate it or work with it to get reliable results?
Yeah, today it's in the end creating a composite that is as close to moon dust as possible and experimenting with that. There were some other organizations, I'm not sure if you remember, Planetary Resources.
Right.
They were a company that was trying to understand, could we mine asteroids for precious metals and other materials? And they actually took an asteroid and ground that up and tried to 3D print with it. That company, I don't believe they still do exist, but the concept is still certainly interesting.
What does this tell you about the future of the entrepreneurial commercial space industry, maybe even the public industry, since, as you've mentioned, NASA is involved with you? Does this give you sort of an inside view as to where this industry might be going and at what rate of speed it might be going there?
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, and don't get me wrong, I don't think additive manufacturing is the only key technology driving space forward, but it certainly is one of the key technologies that has a quite significant impact. And I think the way that we see that is that we all of a sudden have small startups entering the space industry and are actually making an impact, right? I think a great example is the company Launcher. They're also out in California, and they started as a very small team years ago and were one of the first ones to build a full combustion chamber assembly out of copper, and they 3D printed the whole thing and actually had a really, really strong media coverage by that. And today, years later, they now have their first application in space, which is the so-called Orbiter. Orbiter flew on the rideshare on the SpaceX rocket recently and ultimately has the objective to bring space applications such as satellites to custom orbits. And on this orbiter, they have various 3D printed products, such as a fuel tank that is manufactured either out of Inconel 718 or out of Ti-64, out of titanium, that holds fuel for the orbiter vehicle. And they recently now got acquired by a company called Vast, which intends to create a new space station, a new human habitat in space. And they're trying to leverage, especially additive manufacturing capabilities that Launcher has built up within the organization. And, you know, years ago, it would have been impossible to enter the space industry as a startup. The amount of funding that you would have required and needed would have been impossible to get. And today we're, yeah, in a different situation where small startups can make an impact and actually then get accumulated into larger organizations.
You have another email from James. This time is across the country in Boston. And James says, I'm particularly interested in the field of space settlement and also the field of space solar power. Besides the use of 3D printing, or maybe 3D printing takes us to the next step, what would be some of the advanced technologies that might enhance our ability to actually build an orbital space hotel and an effective workable space solar power system?
It's a good question. I'm certainly no expert in solar power, so I can only speak vastly to it. But ultimately, I believe that artificial intelligence is certainly a technology that we shouldn't underestimate. It allows for really, really good simulations of various manufacturing technologies. It allows for now designs that we would have never even thought be possible. Why? Because the human mind cannot even generate such designs. And here a great company example is Hyperganic. Hyperganic is trying to rethink the way that we design applications and parts by not designing with a CAD model, really, but by designing via code. And therefore, the input parameters for a design are physics models and are certain process limitations of the manufacturing technology, such as 3D printing. And therefore, that technology comes up with designs that are potentially highly efficient, that are potentially revolutionizing a certain application space that would be really difficult for a human to do. And therefore, I see, you know, also the combination of various technologies coming together in order to then create innovative applications that we haven't seen before.
Where is Hyperganic a U.S. company, or where is it located?
Hyperganic, I believe, is a German-based organization, but I'm not 100% sure where their official headquarters are.
What about taking these technologies and advancing the field of human spaceflight? So we see satellites and different kinds of technology, and certainly propulsion advancing. There's no question about that, and the manufacturing of it advancing. Let's switch to human spaceflight. How is this used? I can imagine AI is probably playing a role in making human spaceflight more plausible and maybe more safe. Tell us about human spaceflight and some of these advancements.
Sure. I think you hit the nail on the head, right? In human spaceflight, it's all about safety. And some of the disasters that we've had in the past, I think we understand now way better on how to prevent these types of disasters. And, what I said earlier, which is, you know, reducing multiple components into one component and therefore reducing welds or brazing points within applications, which therefore reduces the weakness points of a part, can definitely make a very big impact when it comes to safety. On top of that, you know, due to the fact that when we talk about additive manufacturing, we really talk about a digital manufacturing technology, meaning I have a digital file, and this digital file gets recreated as a whole from that 3D printer. And now combining additive manufacturing with simulation technologies, not only during the printing process, but also for the final application and simulating its performance, and adding a layer of in situ and non-destructive testing technologies to it, I think we can get a very good understanding of creating a so-called digital twin of a final application, and therefore having a way better understanding of any defects within the part that therefore then allows us to make testing a bit cheaper and therefore make spaceflight also safer and a bit more accessible.
What is the durability of these 3D printed parts? I've got two questions from listeners kind of asking the same thing. So one is Josh in Tucson, and another one is Carla in Denver. I guess what they want to know is, are these parts that are made by 3D printing durable, and are they more durable than if they were manufactured more conventionally?
Yes, so these parts are durable. As I mentioned, all major American space companies use additive manufacturing, especially for their combustion chambers, which are, of course, the parts of a rocket that get the most stresses, get exposed to the most stresses. And, today I would say there is still a lot of improvement to be done. Today, these chambers can be reused multiple times, but not in the hundreds, right? And that's, I think, where we want to move towards as the space industry. And one of the limitations that we still have today is that, ultimately, additive manufacturing is a micro welding process, which means we're really melting small metal particles together that have the size of between 20 and 60 microns in diameter. And therefore, the grain structure of the final part is also quite small. And small grain structures aren't typically great for fatigue properties. And what we're working on and what researchers in the industry are working on, such as Cusack Cordero from the MIT, who's an assistant professor at the MIT, he's working on new materials and post-processing technologies that improve the grain structure of additively manufactured materials to a pretty large grain size, almost a centimeter, which can significantly have an impact on fatigue and long-term benefits and properties of these applications. So to shorten up the answer, they are high-performance applications that get created with additive manufacturing. They have superior performance properties to conventional manufactured parts. Nevertheless, we can still improve these types of applications to continuously bring down the cost of spaceflight.
Ben is in Phoenix, Arizona. And by the way, listeners, your emails are fine. It would be great if you gave us a call. I know many of you are still at work, and because it is Friday morning, at least on the West Coast, 866-687-7223 if you would like to call us. Ben says, I'm not quite sure for in-space applications where the material is coming from for the manufacturing of whatever it is you want to manufacture. Do you have to bring up to space a significant amount of raw material in whatever bulk form it would be? And is that a large quantity? Or somehow are you already able to use space-based material?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, printing space parts on Earth is commodity, and all major space companies do that. Printing in space is still a research topic, right? There is a 3D printer on the ISS. It's a it's a somewhat simple 3D printer that you could also buy for your home. These are typically called FDM technologies, and they use a filament and a heating nozzle to print plastic / polymer parts. So in that case, yes, you have to bring up the raw material. One of the benefits of 3D printing really is that you don't, besides bringing up different materials such as a polypropylene or a nylon on the polymer side or an aluminum or a copper on the metal side, your base dark material is always the same. It's either a powder or it's a wire or it's a filament, right? And whether you print a small part or a big part, you still use the same base material. So therefore, the complexity of supplying material in space is quite reduced compared to conventional technologies where you have different raw material. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, there are also companies and there's research going on using material that can be found on space, whether if it's moon dust, whether if it's asteroids that have oftentimes precious metals partially enclosed in them. That is all, I think, still future scenarios, but certainly highly interesting.
Again, listeners, we'd love to hear from you by phone, 866-687-7223. I have a change of pace email question from Chris in New York, and he says, I want to ask you a question on something that is different from what you've been talking about, but possibly down the road, depending on how space settlement and humans in space unfold a long time in the future, may be applicable there too. I am fully aware that there are a few companies in the United States, and maybe there are some outside the United States, that are seriously working hard and well-funded to 3D print body organs for transplant. Many people may not understand this, but to give listeners a little bit of an introduction to this, I have a very close friend who was transplanted with a kidney. The kidney was infected with a virus. Now she has the virus. She's 60 years old. The kidney is not functioning well. It is unlikely that at her age, and now that the virus is throughout her whole body, she could get another kidney transplant. So she may be facing a lifetime on dialysis or something even worse. But I understand that companies are working to 3D print body organs. I'm wondering if you're aware of any of this and you can update us on the progress of something like this actually happening and getting into the marketplace.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic that I also am very interested in on a personal level. There is 100% research going on in that space. There are well-funded organizations, whether out of research institutes, but also, interestingly, out of 3D printing companies that currently 3D print plastic and are now looking into 3D printing cell-based materials. We're certainly not there yet. I think there's very early stage studies going on of printing non-critical organs. There have been, I believe, successful printing studies on skin cells that, if I'm not mistaken, have been transplanted to living organisms. But there are certain complexities, of course, with 3D printing organs, such as do we only need stem cells, or can we also shift to different media and therefore reduce the cost of 3D printing organs? I think one of the researchers, his name is David Sinclair, is also researching in that direction because he's a longevity researcher trying to understand how to extend the human lifespan. But ultimately, we're still at the very beginning of those journeys. Will it happen? I believe 100% yes. I do believe that we will be able to print organs. What the timeline on this is, I really don't know.
David Sinclair has been a guest on the show, and you've just reminded me to contact him again. I think he's been on twice, maybe, and ask him again.
Wow.
But I'm curious, so I'm supplementing Chris's question. It would seem to me that if you're going to try to 3D print a complex organ like lungs or a kidney or a heart, that you got to have a lot of AI to keep the damn thing working. Is that a fair assessment? Because without some kind of really rapid artificial intelligence that can just do millions of processings almost instantly, I don't see how they could get an organ to work correctly. What's the role of AI in all of this?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, AI could certainly create the structures that no human can design through a CAD system, right? And I think AI will certainly play a role, similar to what I mentioned earlier with a company called that I mentioned called Hyperganic. They're certainly not in the space of organ printing, but really, if I create a very complex structure or even organic structure out of metal, I can apply the same principles to a organ 3D printing process. And on top of that, I think also not to underestimate the power that stem cells have, being able to transform themselves from a stem cell into any human body cell, whether if it's liver tissue or a kidney tissue or a bone tissue. Right, where we are today, which I think is important to point out, today we are 3D printing human implants on a daily basis. So a good amount of hip implants today are 3D printed. We see custom facial implants for cancer patients being 3D printed now, with a turnaround time of 4 days, meaning from a CT scan to a final part that can go into surgery within 4 days, which is incredible. And all of these are printed out of titanium materials, which very well adopt in the human body. And what's critical and crucial about the process of 3D printing is that we can recreate the bone structure of on that implant, which allows therefore for a faster patient recovery, a better bone ingrowth of bone into the titanium implant, and therefore even today, with additive manufacturing, we are improving patient lives through implants.
So, listeners know I recently completed a lot of dental repair work from a dog attack several years ago. So, the last round, which included bone grafts and all sorts of crap in my lower jaw, plus a four-tooth front tooth bridge, all 3D printing at a state-of-the-art dental school in San Francisco. They did the work. So the amount of photographs and measurements that they took, it was multiple visits to the dental office and multiple impressions that they had to take. And sometimes they had to redo an impression because a measurement might just be a tiny bit off. And, of course, it was students learning to do it under you know, their professors teaching them. So, but the end result was that almost all of the lower work was 3D printed out of titanium. So I have that in my mouth right now, and so far so good. So
perfect. You're a living example of the advancement.
Yeah, and the first round when the dog attack first happened in 2016, that upper tooth bridge is all made the traditional way. And I can't tell the difference. And probably nobody else could tell the difference either. So very interesting technology. Listener John in Fremont posted on our blog an article about EOS and Hyperganic and what they're doing, and it gives some links in it. So listeners, if you're interested in following up on that from what Fabian has said, thank you to John for giving us that information, and I'd like to try to contact them, John, and see if they might be interested in being on the space show. And Fabian, you have a caller that's waiting patiently to talk to you. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Yes. It's not been that bad, David. This is AJ Katari from Washington, D.C. area.
Hi, AJ.
Hi.
AJ.
Hi. My question is about the application of this technology to for nuclear power, basically thorium molten salt reactor. If we want to do micro reactors with that and build channels, heat exchangers basically, using C6 material or possibly C/zircon OC, that kind of material. Now, these materials, obviously, C6 melting temperature is more than 1200 degrees centigrade, and the other one is more like 1500 degrees centigrade. So can this 3D printing be done for those heat exchanger channels using 3D printing, can that be done for those materials or not?
Yes, so very interesting question and really good point. So nuclear applications, we actually already have a few organizations such as Westinghouse, who is using additive manufacturing to improve existing reactors or to circumvent supply chain issues by 3D printing applications, whether it's conventional manufacturing or existing suppliers. When it comes to high temperature heat exchangers, that is certainly no issue. I mean, the example I mentioned earlier in the space industry, so combustion chambers experience temperatures even higher.
Yes.
And really, the lasers that melt the base material are up to 1 kilowatt in strength, so they can certainly melt these types of materials. If it's exactly those materials that we would print, or we would pivot to a similar alloy with similar characteristics but better printability,
mm-hmm.
could be the case. But nevertheless, we are working with companies in the space of microreactors. We're also working with companies in the space of nuclear fusion. So one company called TAE, they're one of the organizations looking into nuclear fusion, and they're using or thinking about using additive manufacturing also for heat exchange applications.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, they're using high conductivity alloys such as copper, chromium, zirconium in order to get the high amounts of heat out of the fusion reactor, which, as you know, can go up to a billion degrees at the final stage. So I really don't see a reason why additive manufacturing would not be applicable to the heat exchanger application that you're referring to.
Okay, so that means that one can use a powder form or some other form of C6 or C-zirconium OC, and then melt it and make channels from that using additive manufacturing. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Sure, yeah. In theory, yes, I would have to take a closer look at the material and at the properties. But ultimately, one rule of thumb is anything that's weldable can be 3D printed, and even certain materials that are not weldable or well-weldable can be 3D printed.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, if you even want to shoot me a note, or David can connect us, we could certainly have a follow-up conversation about your
Sure. Story. Yeah, I think I would like to. I would like that, and David has my contacts.
I'll introduce you both after the show via email.
Perfect.
Sure, very good. And the other question is its application for hypersonic scramjets for active cooling, especially active cooling channels in combustor and nozzle. I think that actually my company, David will tell you that later, many years ago, about 10 years ago or so, 3D printed a small model of something similar. I can't go into details about that, but something similar and was, quite possible to do really small active cooling channels and things like that. So that was really, that was, of course, many, many you know, many years ago. Now I'm sure that things are just wonderfully better. And what you are talking about is just really very, very interesting. And this micro reactors that I'm talking about is something that can be useful terrestrially, but can also be useful, and of course I'm talking about molten salt reactor that thorium or uranium-233 molten salt reactor that David knows, you know, that well about, that I'm interested in and stuff that I've been working on. So there, and also on, so that what I was trying to say is that on space, in space, on the moon, Mars also, of course, but cislunar space also, that would be of interest to Space Force. All of these possibilities exist for 3D printing. If one can do it with, you know, various different metals and various different things, and what you said just now, that if it can be welded, it can be 3D printed, you know, more or less. So that's very interesting. Yeah. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, AJ. Appreciate it. Now
thank you.
I'll send you guys in
thank you.
When the show over. Okay.
Sure. Bye. Thanks, AJ.
Christine is in Seattle. She has an email for you, and she says, I'm curious about the power consumption requirements for 3D printing in space. Are these power hogs, or how much power do they need, or how do you deliver sufficient power to 3D printing in space?
Yeah, so they're not power hogs. It depends on the machine and the and on the size of it. Between, you know, a 220 volt to 440, that's pretty much standard. Depending on the laser unit, really, that a 3D printer is using. If you talk about polymers, you talk about, of course, lower melting temperatures of the base materials, and therefore, in our case, we use CO2 lasers, which go up to 70 watts, which really doesn't have that high of a power requirement. If you're trying to melt a material with a higher melting point, such as aluminum, you definitely need at least 400 watts, and if you're going even higher than that to materials that also are a bit more difficult to melt, such as the copper, because it reflects a lot of the energy, then you need to go up to a kilowatt laser system. If we talk about more small size desktop based 3D printers, they really have very standard power requirements. You could plug them into the wall in your house.
But if you were trying to 3D print a lunar habitat, you'd have to be able to deliver some substantial power to that, I would imagine, then.
Correct, right? And if we talk about lunar habitats, I mean, those guys, they typically use even standard robotics in certain cases, like a Fukuoka or a Fanuc robot. I'm not too versed with their power requirements, but I'm certain they're certainly quite high in that case.
You have another call. Let me take that. Hang on. Good morning, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hey, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Hey, John.
Hi. I was wondering how soon do you think we'll be able to have a 3D printer print a copy of itself?
I love that question. So there are components even of our 3D printers today that are 3D printed, right? So certain flow nozzles that we need to distribute argon gas or nitrogen gas within the 3D printers for certain materials are 3D printed. Even some of the door handles that we do are 3D printed. The big question is, do we need to have a 3D printer 3D print itself, right? Because ultimately, not everything benefits from being 3D printed. There's other technologies out there that, you know, have been around for 10,000s of years, like casting, that are more efficient and cheaper than 3D printing for certain geometries and certain applications. So I think today we could probably print a good amount of a 3D printer, but it wouldn't be cost efficient. Typically, we try to look at the applications that are super complex, that have high assembly rates within them. Those are the candidates that we look at from a 3D printing perspective to, A, reduce cost, and, B, also improve the efficiency and the performance of certain applications. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, we're a long ways off, I think. But definitely artificial intelligence will have to advance quite a bit before we're able to do that.
And there are certain components that would be difficult to print, like, for example, the laser unit itself, right? Laser is quite the complex application. 3D printing some of these components, 3D printing lenses, so there's a lot of also glass and mirror type applications within a 3D printer that'd be difficult. So yeah, I would agree, especially for certain parts of it, we're certainly still ways out.
Are you familiar with Alex Murray up in Carleton University in Ottawa?
I am not personally.
Okay. He's a proponent of advancing self-replicating machines for space settlement. So, you know, the holy grail obviously would be to put equipment up on the moon and be able to, you know, self-replicate factories on the moon. So, he's working on this from a biological standpoint. In other words, looking at life on Earth and how it evolved, and then you know, how inanimate material is transformed into living systems, and then he's translating that into mechanical systems. And it's a very interesting approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting.
So.
And
yeah, David, I'll post a link on your blog to an article he published back in 2020 in the Journal of Biomimetics, and his concept for self-replicating machines, and it's pretty interesting.
Okay. Anything else from you, John?
No, great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Listeners, we're getting close to the 60-minute limit. Our guest has a meeting that he must attend. So if you want to get a quick call in, you need to hurry. 866-687-7223. Joshua, Denver, Colorado, says, what do you think is the next big 3D printing or additive manufacturing discovery or innovation that is going to come about, and will we see it in 2023?
Man, that's a good question. There's a lot of advancements in the technology. One of the biggest trends in metal additive manufacturing today is what we refer to as support-free printing in the industry. If you look at a lot of metal 3D printing technologies up until a few years ago, you needed support structures to print certain geometries. Typically, the standard was over 45 degrees in an angle. Today, mainly due to the fact that we have advanced in monitoring solutions, so we have optical tomography cameras within our 3D printer that on a layer-by-layer basis measure the energy intensity that we put into the so-called powder bed. And we have, of course, also, I wouldn't go as far as artificial intelligence, but we have algorithms that now understand how much energy is too much and how much energy is not enough. And therefore, we are now able to truly 3D print metal applications with close to no support structures in very complex geometries. And that allows for various things. A, it brings down the cost of metal 3D printing quite significantly. And B, it allows for even more complex geometries that weren't possible before. A great example is impellers. So we can now print closed impellers out of a Inconel 718, for example, without having to remove support structures out of that impeller. So that's, I think, a very big trend that we see in 2023. We're launching that technology, or just launched it this year, at various 3D printing shows. On the polymer side, we also see new technologies that accelerate the 3D printing process. We call one of these technologies laser profusion, which ultimately goes away from a single laser and goes towards laser diodes. That ultimately, you could imagine, instead of having one or two lasers, you now have a million lasers exposing the material, and therefore ramping up processing times by at least 10x, if not more. And therefore, you know, we see a continuous trend of reducing cost of the end product of 3D printing, which allows us to get into new application spaces. And I think what's really interesting too is that we now see companies such as Wilson to adopt 3D printing for consumer goods, right? And we recently had a 3D printed basketball on the latest dunk contest from the NBA, which was was completely new to the world.
Does it work? Is it a good basketball?
Yeah, it has the exact same properties as a professional NBA basketball, and it never deflates.
Wow, so you could do the same thing with a football, I would imagine, then.
Yeah, you could do the same thing with a football, with a baseball, with a lot of different applications. So,
Your last question will be Harold in Los Angeles, and he says, it seems to me that for 3D printing to advance, the field of material science has to keep advancing. Which one is advancing faster, the printing or the material science side?
I love that question because it's 100% true. I think today the 3D printing side has probably more funding than the material science side, but we do definitely see a lot of advancements in material science. We see new alloys and new concepts coming out, even from startups that, for example, dry blend certain ceramics into aluminum powder, and therefore you create a aluminum ceramic matrix during the printing process, which can create very interesting applications. But we also see people like the MIT, for example, looking into alloys that were developed 50 years ago and weren't processable back then. And they're trying to understand, are these alloys now 3D printable? And could we revive them and actually open new application spaces to these alloys? And therefore, I 100% agree with that statement. We need material science in additive manufacturing in order to truly and consistently advance the technology.
I know that you have a time limit, so we need to call it a halt and to ask you if we've left something out. I don't think we've even begun to touch the field. So hopefully we can talk to you again down the road. This is a fascinating field, and you've opened the door for us on it. And I hope we can check in with you later on and frequently to stay up on what's happening in this arena, and it's been fascinating talking to you for an hour, and I certainly look forward to more conversations with you down the road on the Space Show, and hopefully you'll be there for us and you'll be willing to come back on the show.
Yeah, I would love to be back. Thank you so much for having me today. I had a blast. This was a really awesome format. As I said, we also have a podcast called Added a Snack, so there's also possibly some interesting episodes for some listeners to check out. I'll definitely continue follow your show, David.
Okay.
I thought, you know, I had a blast, as I said earlier. And, yeah, everybody have a great rest of your day.
Absolutely, and we want to thank you for being with us. By the way, what city are you in? Where are you physically located?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Oh, Austin. Okay. All right, we'll be in touch with you, and I want to thank and shout out to Brad for helping to arrange this show, and he did a lot of work and a lot of emails and spent a lot of time, and Brad, we appreciate it. It's a great program this morning, and thank you very much for your support in making it happen. And Bobby, and we'll talk to you down the road, and good to meet you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good to meet you as well.
Okay. Listeners, that's it. We are coming up on the weekend. Hopefully you will enjoy whatever it is you're going to do. Stay safe and have a good time. And as always on The Space Show, keep looking up. And we will be back Sunday, daylight savings time, don't forget, with open lines. Once again, goodbye from our guest today, Fabian, all of you who called and emailed, and from David and The Space Show.